Hare Mr. Bhattacharya thought the sadhus leaving for America should make an important news story. He accompanied Bhaktivedanta Swami to all the newspapers in Calcutta, the Hindustan Standard, the Amrita Bazar Patrika, the Jugantas, the Statesman, and others. Bhaktivedanta Swami had only one photograph, a passport photo, and they made a few copies for the newspapers. Mr. Bhattacharya would try to explain what the Swami was going to do, and the news writers would listen, but none of them wrote anything. Finally, they visited the Dainik Bashumati, a local Bengali daily, which agreed to print a small article with Bhaktivedanta Swami's picture. Mr. Bhattacharya continued to assist Bhaktivedanta Swami with his final business and speaking engagements. Mr. Bhattacharya, we took a hired taxi to this place and that place, and he would go for preaching. I never talked to him during the preaching, but once when I was coming back from the preaching, I said, "You said this thing about this, but I tell you, it is not this, it is this." I crossed him in something or argued, and he was furious. Whenever we argued, and I said, "No, I think this is this," then he was shouting. He was very furious. He said, "You are always saying, I think, I think, I think. What is the importance of what you think? Everything is what you think. But it doesn't matter. It matters what Shastra says. You must follow." I said, "I must do what I think, what I feel. That is important." He said, "No, you should forget this. You should forget your desire. You should change your habit. Better you depend on Shastras. You follow what Shastra wants you to do, and do it. I am not telling you what I think, but I am repeating what the Shastra says." The day before his departure, Bhaktivedanta Swami traveled to nearby Mayapur to visit the Samadhi of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Then he returned to Calcutta. He was ready. He had only a suitcase, an umbrella, and a supply of dry cereal. He did not know what he would find to eat in America. Perhaps there would be only meat. If so, he was prepared to live on boiled potatoes and the cereal. His main baggage, several trunks of books, was being handled separately by Scindia Cargo. 200 three-volume sets. The very thought of the books gave him confidence. When the day came for him to leave, he needed that confidence. He was making a momentous break with his previous life, and he was dangerously old and not in strong health. And he was going to an unknown and probably unwelcome country. To be poor and unknown in India was one thing. Even in these Kali Yuga days, when India's leaders were rejecting Vedic culture and imitating the West, it was still India. It was still the remnants of Vedic civilization. He had been able to see millionaires, governors, the prime minister, simply by showing up at their doors and waiting. A sannyasi was respected. The Srimad Bhagavatam was respected. But in America, it would be different. He would be no one, a foreigner. And there was no tradition of sadhus, no temples, no free ashrams. But when he thought of the books he was bringing, Transcendental Knowledge in English, he became confident. When he met someone in America, he would give him a flyer, Srimad Bhagavatam, India's message of peace and goodwill. Because India, no matter, Prabhupada says, there's a Bengali saying, says, what do you call it? Mora hati lak taka. Means an elephant, dead or alive, is worth a lakh of rupees. Right? Now it's worth a little more. So in other words, the culture on the Indian subcontinent, even though it may not be properly connected anymore, there's still so many elements of it that are still very worthwhile, like that. You have to know what you're looking for, but still, it's very worthwhile. So that's why to consider India as just another country, no, it's the remnants of the Vedic culture that makes it special. It's not just any old, you know, remnants. Right? You know, it's Vedic culture. In other words, Vedic culture, and then, you know, whatever's happened, you know, by the effect of Kali Yuga. Otherwise, you start in the West, you know, you're starting out with wild guys living in the forest wearing bear skins and walking around with battle axes, right? You know, so that's kind of where you're starting there. Then add Kali Yuga onto that, okay? You know, so. Yeah, so these books, this knowledge, that's what should give one confidence. If one has knowledge, if one has something like this, they have something solid to give. Right? Other things aren't as important. Everybody else has so many things. But this knowledge, that's one thing that nobody has. So if you have that, then everything will work very nice. It was August 13th, just a few days before Janmashtami, the appearance day anniversary of Lord Krishna. The next day would be his own 70th birthday. During these last years, he had been in Vrindavan for Janmashtami. Many Vrindavan residents would never leave there. They were old and at peace in Vrindavan. Bhaktivedanta Swami was also concerned that he might die away from Vrindavan. That was why all the Vaishnava sadhus and widows had taken vows not to leave, even for Mathura. Because to die in Vrindavan was the perfection of life. And the Hindu tradition was that a sannyasi should not cross the ocean and go to the land of the Malechas. Right? Because Yudhishthira Maharaj was king of everything. So all it mentions all the continents. But the sannyasis, the Brahmins, they wouldn't cross the ocean. Generally you'd see the merchants would go across and do like Sumatra is part of Indonesia, no? I guess, yeah. So Sumatra they were doing a lot of trade with Sumatra in India. They take boats across and like that. From South India, they generally go. So there was a lot of trade going on with Sumatra there. Also Malaysia, you know, all the sandalwood trees were there, so you could go either by boat or over land. So, you know, they'd be going around to different places, whatever, something was happening, right? That makes sense? They didn't go other places because not a whole lot was happening, but these were much more. But beyond all that was the desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and his desire was non-different from that of Lord Krishna. And Lord Chaitanya had predicted that the chanting of Hare Krishna would be known in every town and village of the world. Mr. Bhattacharya and Bhaktivedanta Swami took a taxi down to the Calcutta port. Bhaktivedanta Swami was carrying a Bengali copy of Chaitanya Charitamrita, which he intended to read during the crossing. Somehow he would be able to cook on board, or if not, he could starve, whatever Krishna desired. He checked his essentials, passenger ticket, passport, visa, P form, sponsor's address. Finally, it was happening. Srila Prabhupada. With what great difficulty I got out of the country. Some way or another, by Krishna's grace, I got out so I could spread the Krishna consciousness movement all over the world. Otherwise, to remain in India, it was not possible. I wanted to start a movement in India, but I was not at all encouraged. The black cargo ship, small and weathered, was moored at dockside, a gangway leading from the dock to the ship's deck. What's a gangway?
Like, it's a little staircase.
Yeah, it's a little staircase. Like that. You know, it means like the ship's there. It's something movable because the ships are always bigger, smaller, or farther in or out, or move up and down with the water. So there's something that you can put that you can, that, you know, can move up and down also. Indian merchant sailors curiously eyed the elderly saffron-dressed sadhu as he spoke last words to his companion in the taxi, and then left him and walked determinedly towards the boat. Right, because these are merchant marines, so they you know, they learn how to deal with the boats and everything like that, and so then they spend months out. That's their what they do. So they, you know, Indian merchant sailors, so they call them the merchant marines. I'm not sure, they have nothing to do with the army or anything like that, or navy, but that's just what they call them. For thousands of years, Krishna Bhakti had been known only in India, not outside, except in twisted, faithless reports by foreigners. And the only Swamis to have reached America had been non-devotees, Mayavadi impersonalists. But now Krishna was sent... But now Krishna was sending Bhaktivedanta Swami as his emissary. Right? Because before, you only had those who were interested in the Vedic, you know, ideas from the Vedic culture. You know, you take a few ideas here and there and then speculate and make it into your own khichdi. Like that, that was all that was going on. Or others, they were just impersonalists. They had gone to the West. Like even now, if you go to the universities, the professors in that, when they teach philosophy or Indian philosophy or Indian religion like that, it's always from the impersonal point of view like that. You know, they never teach from the Vaishnava point of view. Very few like that. Because that's all whoever went. So now, here, first time then, an actual, you know, pure, unalloyed, bona fide devotee is going. Mr. Bhattacharya, he was alone, a lone fighter. When he left, there was no one on the shore to bid him goodbye. No friends, no supporter, no disciple, nobody. Even if you call me, I was not a disciple of his. I was a disciple of someone else. So I was not his follower. But due to shared love, I had very much respect for him. So I was the only person standing on the shore to say him goodbye. No one was with me. I could not know that it was such an... I could not know that it was such an important thing. Okay, so that ends there. So just kind of in a nutshell, all the different events in Prabhupada's life up to this point. Then 1st September, 1896, then Abhay Charan Day was born in the Calcutta suburb of Taliganj. It's the opposite end of town where he lived. Where the temple is, you go north to Mahatma Gandhi, that's where he was living. But I think on the mother's side, the relatives were in Taliganj, which is exact opposite end of town. Like it's probably as far or farther than that way. And then there, so in that area, then where he was born. Around 1901, began his own Ratha Yatra. Around 1902, began his own deity worship. Right, remember, it's 96, so that means when he was 5, he started Ratha Yatra, and when he was 6, he started deity worship. Like that. So if we were doing somebody else's lineup, when they were 5, they began their first game of marbles. You know, when they were 6, you know, they pushed the first friend down the stairs. You know, all kinds of significant events, you know, would be happening. 1904, entered Muttilal Seal Free School. 1912, mother Rajani died. 1916, entered Scottish Churches College. 1918, married Radharani Dutta. So that means Prabhupada would have been 22. 1920, rejected college diploma and began dressing as a Gandhian. What is dressing as a Gandhian?
Wearing a Yes, khadi cloth, right? Because a handmade threads, hand woven, you know, that's the Indian cloth. 1921, began working as a department manager in Mr. Kartik Chandra Bose's pharmaceutical company. 1922, met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati for the first time. 1923, moved with his family to Allahabad and started the Prayag Pharmacy. 1925, visited Vrindavan for the first time. 1928, encountered disciples of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati at Allahabad and helped them start an Allahabad branch of the Gaudiya Math. 1930, Father Gaur Mohan died. 28th October 1932, traveled to Koshi where he heard Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati speak for the second time. So that's 10 years later, right, from when he first met him. November 1932, received initiation from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati at Allahabad. 1933 to 1934, went to Bombay to start a pharmaceutical business. There he met some of his godbrothers and helped them establish the Bombay branch of the Gaudiya Math. So now he's already helped start two branches of the Gaudiya Math. 1935, February, presented his Vyas Puja homage before the members and guests of the Bombay Gaudiya Math on the appearance day of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. November 1935, met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati at Radhakunda. 13th December 1936, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wrote to Abai asking him to preach the message of Lord Chaitanya in English. January 1st, 1937, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati passed away at Puri. 1938, Abai moved his family and business back to Calcutta to 6 Sita Kanta Banerjee Lane. 1939, his godbrothers honored him with the title Bhaktivedanta. He's still at this time a grihastha. February 1944, began Back to Godhead magazine in Calcutta. 1945, opened a pharmaceutical factory in Lucknow, Abhay Charan Day and Sons. 7th December 1947, wrote to Mahatma Gandhi. 1948, Gita Upanishad manuscript stolen, lost Lucknow factory. 1949, began writing for Gaudiya Patrika magazine. February 1952, received Back to Godhead from Allahabad, revived at Back to Godhead from Allahabad. October 1952, began his Jhansi preaching. 1953, initiated his first disciple, Acharya Prabhakar, in Jhansi. 16th May 1953, grand opening day of the League of Devotees in Jhansi. 1953, his Allahabad business burglarized. 1954, left family. 1955, left Jhansi for Mathura. July 55, began editing Sajjana Toshini from Gaudiya Sangha in Delhi. October 55, relieved of duties with Sajjan Toshini, alone in Delhi trying to preach, right? Because he wanted to expand and develop it and all that, and they thought these plans were too big, so they said, you know, better, we'll just take care of it. February 1956, began Back to Godhead again from Delhi. September 1956, moved to Vamsi Gopal Temple in Vrindavan. January 57, visited Bombay to preach on Acharya Prabhakar's invitation. Spring 1957, solicited members for the League of Devotees in Kanpur. 1958, returned to Bombay for preaching. Fall 1958, wrote Vrindavan Bhajan at Vamsi Gopalji Temple. 20th October 1958, revived Back to Godhead from Delhi after 2 years. December 1958, wrote Viraha Astika for Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's disappearance day. 17th December 1959, accepted sannyas from Kesha Maharaj in Mathura. Early 1960, acquired quarters in Chippewada Temple, Delhi. Fall 1960, published Easy Journey to Other Planets, his first book in Delhi. February 1961, on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's Appearance Day submitted an offering sharply criticizing his godbrothers for not following their spiritual master's orders, right, to work together and preach. July 1962, moved from Vamsi Gopal Ji Temple to Radha Damodar Temple in Vrindavan for writing Srimad Bhagavatam. Late 62, published Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Volume 1 in Delhi. Early 1964, published Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Volume 2. June 64, met Prime Minister Shastri and gave him a copy of Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Volume 1. 31st August 1964, on Janmashtami Day, held festival at Radha Damodar Temple for promoting his Bhagavatam volumes and his mission of preaching abroad. January 1965, published Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Volume 3. May 65, received no objection certificate from India government. June 1965, received his passport. Summer 1965, Sumati Maharaji agreed to send Bhaktivedanta Swami to America. 28th July 1965, obtained visa. 13th August 1965, set sail from Calcutta for the United States. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Okay, oops. So in Volume 2, forward, this is by one big academic who used to be favorable. Not that he's not favorable now, but he might be dead. The story you're about to read is, like many true stories, highly improbable. Why is highly improbable? No one would want to try it, or no one would believe it. It's something that you just wouldn't expect would happen. Right? An elderly Indian Swami comes to New York City in the mid-1960s on a vaguely defined mission, charged by his teacher in India to bring his spiritual message to the West. He arrives in New York with no prior knowledge of America, no base of support, almost no money. He had 40 rupees. And no clear plan of action. It's always the academics, right? You know, I have to say. Vaguely defined and no clear plan of action. What do you mean? You know, just your practical, what you're going to do and all that. But they don't understand that there's a lot more at stake here. You know what you're going to preach, what you're going to do, and how it's going to be done. That's another thing. He moves about the city somewhat aimlessly, lives for a while in an artist's loft on the Bowery, and finally, with help from a few early followers, rents a storefront building in the area known as East Village, the heart of the 1960s drug and counterculture movement. There he begins to preach, and purity of mind and body, and in behalf of devotion to the Hindu god Krishna. What follows is a remarkable... a remarkable tale of faith, determination, and success beyond anyone's expectations. The present volume gives only the beginning of the story, but it tells us in fascinating detail how the first seeds of success were planted in what seemed such unpromising ground. It is a very human story, with a very human A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami at the center. Religions are a composite of many factors, some of which are largely collective products, such as social movements, institutions, and systems of belief and practice. The history of religions is often put in terms of these relatively objective factors, so that religious history becomes part of the more general history of various times and places. The story of Bhaktivedanta Swami reminds us forcefully that there are other factors, more personal and elusive, which also shape the history of world religion. What's elusive? Yeah, hidden, hard to find, hard to catch. You know, like when it's time for work, sorry, some of the boys are very elusive, you know, hard to catch them, like that. So a more personal elusive means they're more subtle. There's more, you know, the personal element, the more individual element, the thought, the faith, the feeling, like that. Social and cultural factors make a difference, but so also do individuals. Holy men, saints, religious leaders, and they're often flawed but faithful followers. That's us. The value of this book is the way in which it brings together these two dimensions, social history and individuals, to describe the founding of a major religious movement. Like generally, when most people do history, especially if they deal with religion, they're just dealing with, you know, what's the form of it, what it looks like, political influences, you know, any other kind of major event. They'll deal with major people by what they did in the way of establishing something or this. But they generally never get into the personal lives of these people. I mean, of course, they have a problem with that in anybody's life, but here in religion, they also seems to be, they miss out on that. So he's pointing out the value of this book is that because these two things, the history and the individuals involved, how they felt, thought, how they interacted and all that. So from that perspective, you don't see that in anything else. No other religious history do you get that. The value of this book is the way in which it brings together these two dimensions, social history and individuals, to describe the founding of a major religious movement. The temporal setting of this story is important. The 1960s was a unique period in American history, a time when major changes were taking place in our society. The place is important also, since New York City is, in general, and East Village in particular, were on the leading edge of these changes. The author of this biography was very much part of this time and place as one of Bhaktivedanta Swami's earliest disciples in New York. From his own recollections, from recordings and writings of the time, and from extensive interviews with other participants, he has put together a series of striking vignettes of the 1960s that have independent historical value. What's a vignette? A very large net. Something that you drizzle on your salad and all that. No? I mean, like, you know, how you say, like, you know, false, you know, stories that, you know, give a particular, you know, little, they're complete in themselves, but they're small, they deal with, like, one point or something, someone's feeling, someone's perspective, something like that. So it's all these different things woven together. That's what makes it so unique. Because mostly it'll be, like, one point of view going through, but here you go through, you have the author explaining, but then you get other people's point of view, what they say, different things like this. You know, so many things, what the papers are saying, what others are saying. You know, it's a big variety of stuff. Yes? How big a variety of stuff? This big? This big? This big? Or going around this big? This big? This way? Diagonals. Circles, squares.
As much as it needs to.
As much as?
It needs to.
As much as it needs to. Okay, very sagacious. Very good. Threading through these scenes, however, and binding the individuals together in collective effort, is the dominant figure of A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Bhaktivedanta Swami seems curiously out of place in this setting. Born in the late 19th century, he had spent his whole career in India, and for many years had lived the life of a celibate Hindu monk. What relevance could he have in the center of American youth culture, where, quote, do your own thing, end quote, was the die for action? And don't trust anyone over 30 was the watchword against authority. Yeah. That was how it worked. The answer to this can best be conveyed in the book which follows. Since spiritual power can never be precisely pinned down, this book will not give a complete answer, nor will all of the massive evidence on which it is based. It is to Bhaktivedanta's credit that he believed in keeping nothing secret, and it is to Satsvarupa's credit that he has presented the events of this critical period as objectively as possible. Seldom before have we had such an intimate and detailed account of a spiritual master bringing forth a new religious movement, and probably never has there been such a wealth of contemporary data to back it up. Those of us who are historians of religion will be working this rich vein for years to come. What does that mean, working this rich vein? Yes, because it comes from like when you're doing mining, so then when there is, let's say you're mining gold, so where there's a lot of gold, and that's a vein, because it just goes in one like path. So here he's saying this rich vein, so that means very, very full. Because mostly it means how many histories do they have in detail of someone starting up a world religion? Right? Not a whole lot. Right, you know, even Jesus, they don't even know where he was since he was like 12 until he was later, much older. They just disappeared. You know, so many things, you just don't know who he is, where he came from, anything. But here you have so much detail. Some who read this book will simply enjoy an absorbing story. Others, perhaps more appropriately, will respond in faith or greater commitment to their own religious quest. Whatever your response, this first published volume of a great religious biography will be a rare treat. Dr. Thomas J. Hopkins, Chairman, Department of Religious Studies, Franklin and Marshall College, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So now, preface. After the disappearance of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, from this mortal world on November 14th, 1977. Many of his disciples saw a need for an authorized biography of Srila Prabhupada. The responsibility of commissioning such a work rested with the governing body commission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. At their annual meetings in 1978, the GBC resolved that a biography of Srila Prabhupada should be written and that I would be the author. According to Vaishnav tradition, if one aspires to write transcendental literature, he must first take permission from his spiritual master in Krishna. A good example of this is Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, the author of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's authorized biography, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. As Krishnadas Kaviraj has explained, quote, in Vrindavan there were many other great devotees, all of whom desired to hear the last pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. By their mercy, all these devotees ordered me to write of the last pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because of their order only, although I am shameless, I have attempted to write this Chaitanya Charitamrita. Having received the order of the Vaishnavas, but being anxious within my heart, I went back to the temple of Madan Mohan in Vrindavan to ask his permission also. Right? In other words, the Vaishnavas have already commissioned him to work, do the work, you know, write the pastimes. But still he went to Madan Mohan to ask his permission. This transcendental process is further described by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada in his commentary on the Chaitanya Charitamrita as follows. from the purport. To write about the transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not an ordinary endeavor, unless one is empowered by the higher authorities or advanced devotees. One cannot write transcendental literature, for all such literature must be above suspicion. Or in other words, it must have none of the defects of conditioned souls, namely mistakes, illusions, cheating, and imperfect sense perception. The words of Krishna and the succession that carries the orders of Krishna are actually authoritative. One must first become a pure devotee, following the strict regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds daily. And then, when one thinks he is actually on the Vaishnava platform, he must then take permission from the spiritual master, and that permission must also be confirmed by Krishna from within his heart. End quote. So to say that Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita is an authorized biography does not mean that it is a flattering portrait commissioned by an official body, but that is an authorized literature presented by one who is serving the order of Krishna and Guru through the disciplic succession. As such, Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita is not written from the mundane or speculative viewpoint, nor can ordinary biographers comprehend the significance and meaning of the life of a pure devotee of God. Were such persons to objectively study the life of Srila Prabhupada, the esoteric meanings would evade them. Right? In other words, your regular biographers, they know how to go in, get facts, find something interesting, bring out some, you know, little things, details. But even if they were to study it very nicely, they'd still miss all the very subtle points. Right? You know, what's esoteric. They would not be able to understand. Because they won't understand devotion to the Lord. They won't understand the subtleties of the philosophy, none of this. So they wouldn't be able to bring this out. Were they to charitably try to praise Srila Prabhupada, they would not know how. But because Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita is authorized through the transcendental process, it can transparently present the careful reader with a true picture of Srila Prabhupada. Right? Because this is from the transcendental process, so it's empowered by the chit potency. Otherwise, what happens, you're just dealing with mundane intelligence. The mundane intelligence can't understand spiritual. It's two different things, right? Does that make sense? You know, like your eyes can't tell smell. They're two different things. They just don't connect. Another important aspect of the authenticity of Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita is the vast amount of carefully researched information that I am able to focus into each volume. The leading devotees of the Krishna Conscious Movement, in addition to giving me permission to render this work, I've also invited the world community of ISKCON devotees to help me in gathering detailed information about the life and person of Srila Prabhupada. The Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, Prabhupada's publishing house, has given me his collection of letters, totaling over 7,000, and scores of Prabhupada's disciples have granted interviews and submitted diaries and memoirs of their association with Srila Prabhupada. Aside from his disciples, we have interviewed many persons in various walks of life who met Srila Prabhupada over the years. The result is that we have a rich composite view of Srila Prabhupada, drawn from many persons who knew him in many different situations and stages of his life. An acknowledgement section in the back of this book lists the persons who are cooperating to bring about Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. Despite the authorized nature of this book, and despite the support of many well-wishers, I must confess that in attempting to describe the glories of our spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, I am like a small bird trying to empty the ocean by carrying drops of water to the land. The picture I have given of Srila Prabhupada is only a glimpse into His unlimited mercy, and that glimpse has only been possible by the grace of Guru and Krishna. Satsrup Das Goswami, Gita Nagari Farm Community, Port Royal, Pennsylvania, October 1979. Okay. Introduction. As the present volume begins, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, age 69, is traveling aboard a steamship from Calcutta to New York. He carries with him the Indian equivalent of $8. I guess 40 rupees was worth more in those days. He has no institutional backing, and no support awaits him. He is coming on the order of his spiritual master to teach Krishna consciousness to the English-speaking world. Planting the seed, that's this volume. Yeah, how come it doesn't say that? They used to say that. That's strange. Oh, here it says. Planting the seed is the story of Srila Prabhupada's first year in America. It is the story of how an individual will, patiently persisting, overcame great obstacles. And it is a story of a time, the 1960s, when American youth underwent a revolution in consciousness. Planting the seed tells how Srila Prabhupada carried the all but forgotten spiritual culture of Vedic India to New York's Lower East Side, and planted it there in the heart of America's cultural turmoil of 1966. The story of the 69 years of Srila Prabhupada's life, before he boarded the steamship for America, is presented in the first volume of this series, A Lifetime in Preparation. The present volume, however, is complete in itself, and the reader meets His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada exactly as did the first persons he confronted in America, where suddenly he appeared as an elderly, golden-skinned Bengali sadhu, very grave and philosophically inward, yet humorous and talkative, a stranger wearing saffron robes and white, pointy shoes and carrying an umbrella. He was simply known as the Swami, and he lived a spiritually dedicated life previously unheard of in the West, translating the Vedic scriptures in his room, chanting Krishna's name, teaching the Bhagavad Gita. When he walked in Manhattan, people would sometimes come up to him on the street and ask who he was and what he was doing, and he would tell them from the Vedic scriptures about Krishna consciousness. Where's Manhattan? What is Manhattan? Some man with a big hat or something? Part of New York. I guess it would depend who you ask. Some would say it is New York, and everything else is an expansion of there. But it's the main island. Whenever you hear of New York and you see pictures of it, it's always that part. And then so it's the main portion, you could say, or most important of New York City. New York's a state, and then New York's a city, and then within the city you have Manhattan. That's one of the main areas. Then you have all these different places on the mainland around it, like that. So basically everything that Prabhupada does takes place in Manhattan, so it's kind of like in the center of the center, right? And then within that, because the ones to take it up are the younger people, and so then that scene is all happening in the Lower East Side, so then that's where it's all going on. So the first year is all spent there. At first, he lived in a tiny rented room, later in a Bowery loft, and finally in a Second Avenue storefront on the Lower East Side, where he drew an affectionate following from the local youth. Srila Prabhupada did not regard his personal history as an important subject for study. His interest was to publish many volumes about Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But according to the spiritual science, a pure devotee of God is as important as God himself, because he delivers the message of Godhead to a forgetful humanity. Srila Prabhupada's life, therefore, is an important and absorbing subject, and it is a tangible proof of the existence of spiritual reality and love of God. Satsrup Das Goswami. Chapter 1, Journey to America. A quote from, "Today the ship is plying very smoothly. I feel today better, but I am feeling separation from Sri Vrindavan and my Lord Sri Govinda Gopinath Radha Damodar. My only solace is Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, in which I am tasting the nectarine of Lord Chaitanya's Leela.
I have left Bharat Bhumi just to execute the order of Sri Bhaktisaranta Saraswati in pursuance of Lord Chaitanya's order. I have no qualification, but have taken up the risk just to carry out the order of His Divine Grace. I depend fully on their mercy so far away from Vrindavan. Jaladutta Diary, September 10th, 1965. The Jaladutta is a regular cargo carrier of the Sindhya Steam Navigation Company, but there is a passenger cabin aboard. During the voyage from Calcutta to New York in August and September of 1965, the cabin was occupied by Sri Abhay Charanaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami, whose age was listed as 69, and who was taken on board bearing, quote, a complimentary ticket with food. The Jaladutta, under the command of Captain Arun Pandya, whose wife was also aboard, left at 9 a.m. on Friday, August 13th. In his diary, Srila Prabhupada noted, quote, the cabin is quite comfortable, thanks to Lord Sri Krishna for enlightening Sumati Maharaji for all these arrangements. I am quite comfortable. But on the 14th, he reported seasickness, dizziness, vomiting, Bay of Bengal, heavy rains, more sickness. On the 19th, when the ship arrived at Colombo, Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, Prabhupada was able to get relief from his seasickness. The captain took him ashore, and he traveled around Colombo by car. Then the ship went on towards Cochin, on the west coast of India. Janmashtami, the appearance day of Lord Krishna, fell on the 20th of August that year. Prabhupada took the opportunity to speak to the crew about the philosophy of Lord Krishna, and he distributed prasad he had cooked himself. August 21st was his 70th birthday, observed without ceremony at sea. That same day, the ship arrived at Cochin, and Srila Prabhupada's trunks of Srimad Bhagavatam volumes, which had been shipped from Bombay, were loaded on board. By the 23rd, the ship had put out to the Red Sea, where Srila Prabhupada encountered great difficulty. He noted in his diary, rain, seasickness, dizziness, headache, no appetite, vomiting. The symptoms persisted, but it was more than seasickness. The pains in his chest made him think he would die at any moment. In 2 days, he suffered 2 heart attacks. He tolerated the difficulty, meditating on the purpose of his mission. But after 2 days of such violent attacks, he thought that if another were to come, he would certainly not survive. On the night of the second day, Prabhupada had a dream. Lord Krishna, in his many forms, means like the Dasa avatars and that, was rowing a boat. And he told Prabhupada that he should not fear, but should come along. Prabhupada felt assured of Lord Krishna's protection, and the violent attacks did not reoccur. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.
You brought this?